Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, presenting the annual Chili Roast starting August 15th on Fridays, Saturdays, and Labor Day, featuring roasted chilies and prepared chili dishes. More at harmonsgrocery.com.
Recently, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Joshua Kaplan wrote a piece for ProPublica about his experience with a man who had infiltrated the right-wing militia movement in this country. Now, it caught our attention for the obvious reasons. This insider, a wilderness survival trainer named John Williams, told Kaplan about the recruiting strategy and the secret training and marketing operations he had uncovered. But we were particularly taken by the Utah angle to the story and just the cloak and dagger intrigue and how the story played out.
John Williams had been ready for a while that he might possibly need to run at a moment's notice. He kept a bag in his closet with everything he would need, which ranged from three pairs of socks and some cash to lockpicking gear and vitamins to these thumb drives that each held more than 100 gigabytes of encrypted documents, which he would plan on quickly getting rid of if he were about to be arrested or killed. And on April 1st, 2023, he grabbed a bag from his closet and rushed to his car. He left dirty dishes scattered around his apartment. You know, he didn't know if armed men were out looking for him, or frankly, if he would ever feel safe to come home again. And he parked his car for the night in the hills outside of Salt Lake City. And he recorded this entry in this voice diary he'd been keeping for a long time, where he, you know, lets out this long sigh and starts laying out the crazy events of the past few days and says that he's been undercover for over 2 years and that he had accidentally exposed himself trying to warn someone that he feared was in danger. And he was sure at that point that at least one person already knew that he was a double agent and said, you know, into his phone in the back of his car, it's only a matter of time before it gets back to everyone else. Then in the daylight, he started getting rid of those thumb drives. You know, he went to a USPS mailbox and dropped off an envelope with no return address containing a thumb drive and a gold medallion from a militia called the Oath Keepers. And it was addressed to me. And then he got in his car and started driving south toward a desert 4 hours from Salt Lake so that he could disappear. So what was on that thumb drive was tens of thousands of files from inside the militia movement, where John had been undercover, rising the ranks of some of the most influential militias in America. And that was tens of thousands of absolutely sprawling archives of private militia chat logs. It was dozens of hours of conversations that John had secretly recorded. You know, I've been interested in militias for a while now, but since January 6th and the Capitol riot, militias have become much more careful to move their activities out of public view. And, you know, of course, with any files, I can't assume they're real. The process of checking them and authenticating them was painstaking, and it took a long time. I did eventually, you know, confirm that these were legitimate. But pretty quickly, it was obvious that this was just an extraordinary and really kind of unique inside window into the militia movement at this critical juncture in American history. Candid and detailed and expansive. And it took me months to go through all of these files, but that alone can reshape my understanding of where the militia movement is right now and what it's been doing and where it's going.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Joshua Kaplan is with us to explain what this freelance vigilante exposed about the inner workings of the militia movement. His article in ProPublica is called The Militia and the Mole.
My interest in them started in earnest with January 6th. And within days of the Capitol riot, I was in D.C. trying to report on what in the world happened that day. And after that, I spent a long time trying to unspool the very complicated backstory of the events, you know, between the 2020 election and January 6th that got us to that point. But inevitably, it brought me into the world of militias. And in part, trying to understand the overlap between militias and kind of more traditional grassroots political activists. The more I learned about them, the more fascinated I was by these organizations. And I would sit with families who blamed militias for snatching their loved ones away from them into these parallel lives where they were going to secret meetings and plotting violence, or in some cases ended up in a jail cell. And was kind of left with the impression from my conversations with these guys and these militias that it was a more sprawling and more complicated movement than much of the public realized, myself included at that time.
Yeah.
And there is all these kind of threads that I wanted to pull of understanding what this actually looks like in practice, who is a part of it, what does it mean for American politics? By the time I first got in contact with John, I wasn't really reporting on it anymore. I mean, if it was, as an outsider, it seemed like the most notorious militia organizations had largely gone dark after the Capitol riot. And so this really got me thinking about those questions in a more serious way again.
So let's talk about John Williams, where he's coming from, like his ideas. You write about coming from he comes from a dysfunctional and unhappy home. He's a, as you put it, a gay child growing up in rural America. I'm not sure how much you can say about where he grew up beyond that. I mean, I think he ended up in Utah, so it did make me wonder. Can you say that much? Is he a product of this state?
I don't want to get into like hometowns or anything like that. I'll just stick with the story. But I mean, to give you a little more sense about John, I mean, he's a loner. He's extremely intelligent, well-read, introspective, but he's also incredibly intense in almost every aspect of his life, and has this, in some ways, Manichaean worldview that leaves little room for moderation. And as you said, he had a very difficult childhood. He's gay, and he said that his father viewed that as a terrible sin. And even in his youth, he'd spend weeks at a time outside, in part just because he wanted to be at home as little as possible. And when he was a young adult, he was convicted of a series of crimes like assault and ultimately spent 3 years in prison. And during his sentence, he resolved to find a more productive way to channel this sort of inner fervor. And when he got out, he was set on becoming a professional instructor in this longstanding interest of his, extreme wilderness survival. And that, he says, is how he first came into contact with the world of armed militias.
What did he learn in prison Because this is something you write about, that it served as this kind of finishing school for kind of this art of deception. I mean, one of the things he told you was when he started to infiltrate these militia groups that that he wouldn't have been as successful if, he said, if I wasn't one of them in some respects. Talk about that part.
So in prison, what he meant there was that this was a, you know, in order to survive that experience, he had to be able to maneuver these volatile situations with corrections officers, with prison gang leaders. A lot of that involved learning how to kind of steer conversations in a direction that benefited him without the other person realizing that's what was going on. And once he started getting in the militias, that was really became his method. And he worked very hard to become, you know, as skilled a liar and manipulator as possible, whether that's doing method acting exercises to be better at selling the persona he was trying to inhabit while he was with his militia comrades, mm-hmm. or, you know, he kept a journal with every lie he told so he wouldn't lose track. He also studied cult leaders to learn how they manipulated people and pick up tricks.
Yeah. So he finds his calling after prison and the sort of inner turbulence of his youth. He finds his calling as a wilderness survival instructor. And this, as you say in the piece, is when he first comes in contact with these militia groups. But it wasn't a good experience. I mean, he found it unpleasant. Didn't want to work with them anymore. And this is the part you say was really the hardest to verify, this part of the story. Because you mention in the piece that you couldn't help wonder if he was hiding a less this is how you put it in the piece, a less gallant backstory.
Well, I mean, I guess what I meant there is that insofar as possible in the story, I tried to hew just the things that I had hard proof of.
Right.
And once he's deep in the militia world, there's hard proof of a lot. I mean, he was recording all these conversations and I was able to authenticate the recording. So it's, you know, as close as one can be to being in the room.
Yeah.
But the hardest thing to verify was exactly how and why he first decided to join these groups. In part because it was inherently private. This was a question of kind of what's in a person's heart. That's always difficult to unspool. And as he tells it, he was kind of embarrassed about his run-in with militias. And as I said, you know, he's a loner. And so he says he didn't tell anyone about this. You know, when he first joined this militia in Utah, he didn't tell anyone in his life, his friends, his family, the FBI, I'm doing this because I want to infiltrate them. Yeah. So, you know, inherently there's no outside proof there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as a reporter, you're always trying to think of, you know, what could other fact patterns be? And one that seemed, you know, obviously plausible was maybe, you know, the actual backstory here is he was enthusiastic about militias, joined them, and then turned. And now is, you know, changing things. And the kind of closest I got to really understanding that is I was able to find evidence that he didn't point me to that supported his account, at least. You know, that he was, I think, like many loners, he was very online in this period. He was posting thousands of times on online forums under pseudonyms. And through a lot of detective work, I was able to find these deleted posts that kind of give this snapshot of how he viewed the world in this critical period when he was prior to January 6, when he was, you know, before he was really involved.
Right.
And he was saying things about the militias that were incredibly negative,
right.
And gelled. You know, they didn't prove the details of his story, but they gelled. It was the same, you know, the same man who was coming to me and giving his opinions years after the fact was, you know, kind of frozen in amber online in that period that is felt like my biggest blind spot until I saw those documents.
He does kind of sound mysterious in terms of his worldview and his political philosophy, because it's not all over the map. But there's you mentioned in the piece he would rail against people who voted for Donald Trump, but he also would rail against the capitalist infrastructure. You know, he would then rail against gun control measures. So I don't know. I was thinking, oh, he's kind of an extreme libertarian. I don't know if you've settled on where he is in terms of his philosophy, but he didn't seem like a leftist, you know, by any stretch.
I mean, I don't want to put a label on it because I think, as you said, there's something, he's idiosyncratic with his beliefs.
Yeah.
But I think kind of a left-wing libertarianism is the closest thing that comes to mind.
Joshua Kaplan, his article for ProPublica is called The Militia and the Mole. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, presenting the annual Chili Roast starting August 15th on Fridays, Saturdays, and Labor Day, featuring roasted chilies and prepared chili dishes. More at harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Joshua Kaplan. He's talking about the informant who reached out to reveal his 2-year infiltration of the militia movement. This was a Utahn, a wilderness survival trainer who Kaplan says practiced the art of deception to move through the ranks of this underground network. He described how the movement is fine-tuning its marketing campaign, how it organizes vigilante operations, and is forging alliances with law enforcement. Kaplan wrote the piece for ProPublica. It's called The Militia and the Mole. You write about that what really sort of triggered or provoked John Williams to go and try to infiltrate these groups was January 6th. What did he think January 6th meant for the country? One of the things you say is there was this discussion, of course, that was going on about the end of democracy, but he took that literally. So what did he make of that? How did that provoke him?
Yeah, I mean, how you describe this now is a terrorist attack on the seat of the government. It was a very, all the kind of lofty rhetoric that was coming from pundits right after January 6th about democracy being in peril. I mean, that was something he, as you said, I mean, he took it literally. And something he's analogized it to me before is to Pearl Harbor, when after Pearl Harbor, there was this upswell of people who wanted to join the military and fight against the Japanese. And so as he tells it, he felt he was outraged and he felt ashamed for having helped these groups in some small way by training them in wilderness survival. And he assumed that countless Americans would respond with some form of aggressive action, and he wanted to be a part of that. And that is when he reached back out to this militia that he'd kind of had a run-in with before, this time to join, and to do his own version of, freelance undercover detective.
Yeah. What's his plan? He wants to infiltrate the movement on spec, is how you put it. What's the plan?
Remarkably, he didn't have a plan. he knew he wanted to do something and thought that this was something he'd be able to do. He wanted to find a way to damage these organizations kind of independently. But remarkably, he thought of himself as like a sleeper agent, as a, I'm going to learn more. And once I've learned more and I'm in a position of some trust in these groups, I might be able to figure out what to do that will really make an impact, like a wait and see. And so it took a year or two for him to really settle on a vision of, how to make all this worth it. I mean, our early conversations, that seemed to be something that was consuming him, of, you know, how to make sure this wasn't a dangerous and incredibly self-destructive waste of time that lasted at that point, you know, almost 2 years.
So you mentioned that after January 6th, the most sort of notorious groups seemed like they had kind of gone dark, which makes sense. Federal officials are going to be paying attention to these kinds of groups surely after what had happened. But I guess what's going on is they didn't go away, of course. It seems like what they started was this really big recruiting phase. Like, they shifted away for a moment from talking about, you know, domestic terrorism and, you know, getting after their enemies. And they were focusing on just, it seems like, just recruiting, getting more converts. And it seems to be working. Is that what's going on?
I think there's a couple of factors at play there. I mean, one is part of the reason it seemed like they've gone dark was they just become more careful. Hmm. If you were paying attention to the right quarters of the internet in the lead up to January 6th, you could have a sense that something like that was going to happen.
Right.
And one thing I learned through over the course of this reporting is that some of these major militias have continued to do dangerous vigilante operations around the country, for instance, and, you know, contemplation, heated debate around whether they should escalate things even further and commit acts of mass political violence. But even when, in one case that can, you know, expand on, you know, one of their members who is, you know, a leader in this militia AP3, sparked a national news cycle, became the center of a national news cycle, where something he did caused controversy and days and weeks of coverage from, you know, the big newspapers and TV stations. No one ever figured out that he was not a lone wolf, that he was part of a militia, you know, engaging in a militia's secret national operation. And the militia worked really hard to try to keep that a secret. And so that's one piece of the puzzle here. But then to get to your more, I think, important point, January 6th, it caused a crisis for these organizations, you know, not just because of the FBI crackdown, which was a huge part of it, but also because for a time there was, after the Capitol riot, it created a real stigma to being part of a militia, including for many conservatives in the MAGA movement. You know, people were losing friends, losing jobs over their militia ties. The result in the militias I've looked at is they were hemorrhaging members. And these militia leaders who, you know, are tend towards bravado in private, they were saying to each other, we may not survive the backlash of this. This may be, the militia movement may go dark for an extended period of time because of what happened. And there's a couple factors that allowed them to come back. But I think perhaps the most significant one was this unforeseeable change in the political climate. After January 6th, you know, immediately after January 6th, Trump was condemned the rioters in incredibly harsh terms. Yeah. But within a few months, he and other prominent political figures started to change their tune and started to embrace the rioters as patriots, as political prisoners. And that had a very concrete, measurable impact on militias. I could see laid out explicitly in these files where suddenly you started having people, rather than quitting the group because of they were disgusted by January 6th, joining because January 6th inspired them. And before long, these militias were bringing in so many people that their leaders were struggling to keep up with them, all the new recruits.
In the summer, you reported a story for ProPublica where you identified these groups as, you know, one of the most consequential and volatile social movements of our time. I wanted to ask you about one of the things you mentioned in your reporting was that groups like AP3 had already sought to, as you put it, shape American life through armed vigilante operations. Like they were at the Texas border, they were outside ballot boxes. And here's the other critical thing, because it gets us back to the story that you wrote with John Williams, is that these leaders had forged alliances with law enforcement around the United States. Let's talk a little bit about that part. And I think – I guess it could get us to before we actually jump into that point, a character that John Williams encounters, a man by the name of Bobby Kinch, who's a former law enforcement. That's the connection there. Tell us about Bobby Kinch, and that'll get us to the what John Williams found about the effort to really rope in and involve and recruit, you know, local active law enforcement officials. Can we start there with Bobby Kinch?
Yeah, and Bobby Kinch is a fascinating figure. He is the head of the Oath Keepers in Utah, and he has a fascinating backstory. He's a very charismatic man, but he is a retired detective who spent 23 years in the Las Vegas Metro Police. At one point, he served on what he called the Black Squad, investigating violent crimes where the suspect was African-American. And he left the force not very long after a scandal that started when he posted on Facebook that he was ready for a race war. And Kinch has said that he joined the Oath Keepers because after he turned in his badge, he had this feeling that he wasn't done yet. And you know, it's hard to summarize all the chilling details and stories that emerged from this reporting about Bobby, but his nostalgia about the thrill of high-octane police work, I think, shed some light on why so many current and former officers join militias. One thing he said at one point has stuck with me, and I'm paraphrasing here, but when people tell me that violence doesn't solve anything, I look back over my police career and I'm like, wow, that's interesting, because violence sure did solve quite a bit. There's this kind of constant reference point between when he was in the force and was authorized to use violence on behalf of the government, you know, in the name of public safety, and his time in the militia, where militias are always at least adjacent to the idea of using force for, you know, what they view as legitimate goals. But now they have no authority to do so. They're trying to change the country just however they see fit through force of, in many cases, with guns.
Yeah. He, John Williams has he ingratiates himself with Kinch, becomes, friend is maybe too strong a word, but he goes and stays at his house. I mean, like, he's really in at this point, John Williams, with Bobby Kinch. And he has a close call. Kinch's dog almost uncovers this bug that John Williams has with him in doing these – in this part of this infiltration. Just say something about this moment. It's a pretty dramatic moment in your article.
What happened there is John stayed for the night in Bobby Kinch's guest room in this cabin kind of outside Zion in the mountains, a very remote cabin. In the morning, they were drinking coffee before they were going to make the drive to this very important Oath Keepers leadership meeting. And John had purchased a bug off Amazon, actually, so that he'd be able to record everything. And it looks like just like a little USB drive, unless you actually look at it closely, and then you start to see things like there's microphone holes and there's a little on-off switch, and it becomes kind of obvious that it's a bug. And as they're drinking coffee, the bug was attached to a charging device, and Bobby's dog snatched it out of John's back. And they both notice this at the same time. The dog's running around with the bug like it's a tennis ball. And as Bobby goes to retrieve whatever's in his dog's mouth, John starts to panic. He's like, how in the world am I going to explain this? I mean, you know, he's learned enough about Bobby to be very scared of making him angry. And so he looks around and he sees Bobby's handgun sitting on the kitchen counter, and he thinks, if he even starts to look at it, I'm going to grab his gun, I'm going to shoot him, and I'm going to flee into the woods. Bobby takes the bug out of the dog's mouth and hands it right back to John and starts to apologize. And John goes, you know, don't worry about it. He's a puppy. And they drive off to the meeting together with Bobby seemingly none the wiser that he'd been in this incredibly perilous and fraught situation.
I think this part of the story about the local law enforcement, the efforts of these militia groups to make these alliances with law enforcement is really interesting, and I wanted to ask you about it. What does John Williams uncover about the alliances, in particular between these groups and Utah law enforcement? In this trove of documents that you get, you see things like, we're making progress locally on the law enforcement. At one point, someone says at least three of the people of this group can get the sheriff on the phone any time of the day. One of them says the sheriff is my tie-in to the state attorney general because he's friends. Which, I mean, these are big implications here. It implicates the state's attorney general, implicates some sort of sheriff. At some point you identify, or John Williams identifies, the sheriff as the sheriff for Iron County. So how extensive is this relationship? And this is another one of those things you had to go out and confirm. But what can you say about the relationship between these militias and local law enforcement in the state in particular?
Yeah, I mean, to, you know, talk a little bit more about Iron County first, I spoke with Sheriff Carpenter.
This is Ken Carpenter, we should say.
Yeah. And it was a really interesting call. I mean, he told me that he declined an offer to actually join those keepers, but he had a lot of positive things to say about them. He said he's known quite a few members and thinks they're generally good people. And he, you know, confirmed some of what the militias had said about their relationship. You know, that this militia leader, who is kind of the Oathkeepers' lead on building law enforcement ties in the state, periodically contacted him about issues like ATF regulations that the Oathkeeper believed were unconstitutional. And the sheriff said that, you know, if he agreed with the Oathkeeper, he would contact the Attorney General's office about it. And it was kind of, you know, and he talked about them as, you know, essentially engaged constituents, for the most part, I think would be a fair way to characterize all of that. And I mean, I think where this really becomes interesting is you know, there is a striking preponderance of former and current law enforcement officers, sometimes very high ranking, in the Oathkeepers and in other organizations. But what was really unique here was being able to see some of these militias playbooks for building those ties. And both, I talked with a lot of militia guys about this, but also the files made this really clear. You know, they see this as crucial to their success. Because, you know, like I said earlier, I mean, I think the core activity of these organizations is, the defining activity is paramilitary training and vigilante operations that involve putting themselves into very volatile situations while heavily armed. So that might be, for instance, you know, showing up at a Black Lives Matter protest in full military, tactical gear with semi-automatic rifles. And in that sort of situation, if the police aren't going to actively support them, they at least want them to leave the militia alone. It's an environment where they think it could be very useful to have the cops see you as a friend. And so the sheer amount of effort and organization and kind of bureaucracy that goes into cultivating these relationships around the country. I mean, in AP3, members received a spreadsheet from senior leadership of every sheriff in their state with instructions to reach out to them all and report back which ones were friendly and which weren't. And there's all of this, kind of constant trading, honing these business school group project as tactics for deepening these ties, how to pitch yourself, how to become friendly with one officer and use that to get to the higher ranking officers, and how to it's a pretty impressive approach. It's incredibly thorough in some cases.
Joshua Kaplan, his article for ProPublica is called The Militia and the Mole. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the reporter Joshua Kaplan. We're talking about his story for ProPublica, The Militia and the Mole. You know, it seems like there's a... In the popular imagination, it seems like there's a type when someone thinks of a member of a militia. You know, ex-military, former cop, into survival skills, deeply conservative in their ideology, that's the type. But one of the things you write in this story is that the stature of the men leading these groups in this time now after January 6th, that startled you. Is the type the same? Because it seems like you describe it as a kind of new generation of militia leaders. What's the new generation that's different maybe from the older one, if it's different?
I don't know if it's different. Although these are people that you don't generally hear about being in these groups. Mm-hmm. But in the leadership of the Oath Keepers, there was a very successful doctor, an OBGYN who used to work for the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. Right. And then at the time of these Oath Keepers meetings, he was the CEO of a subsidiary of United Health Group as a militia leader. That was really surprising to me. And then, joining him at these Oath Keepers board meetings, you had a city prosecutor in Utah.
Yeah.
An ex-city councilman, active duty law enforcement. One of the fascinating things about this, about the movement as a whole, though, is just how wide a range of people they managed to keep connected. Because keep united under one banner, I should say. Because these are organizations that bring together doctors like that with convicted criminals, where their roster includes men with avowed white nationalist ties and black conservatives. There's this big tent philosophy and a lot of desire to kind of, I think intentional vagueness about what exactly they're all doing this paramilitary training for, that allows them to be much larger than the militias of, say, the 90s, and also to bring a much wider range of people together. It's a really fascinating dynamic.
Yeah. I think that's one of the big questions that I took from the piece was how dangerous are they really? I mean, you could be tempted to think that they're just kind of posing, that it's a kind of performative thing, that they're just weekend warriors who talk big. But then you write about – one of the things you write do in the piece is write about these secret operations that John Williams uncovers. One of these is this red list of journalists, and it involved in one case staking out a student reporter at Southern Utah University, putting together a dossier for a Salt Lake Tribune reporter. They created a file for a local film critic who had the audacity to – I think it was like one of the tweets by the Salt Lake Tribune reporter. I mean, these are actual people who were at least – I don't know if they were stalked, but the fact that they're on some sort of list does make you wonder. Say more about this list and what John Williams uncovered here.
Yeah, I mean, so there were these dossiers about these local reporters that had kind of offended the militia in one way or another, or gotten on their radar in the case of the student journalist. It was just a college kid who showed up to a protest they were at to write about it. And these dossiers included the journalist's address, phone number, pictures of their house, along with this kind of very angry manifesto about basically how evil this reporter was. And, you know, something John was told in these files is that they'd done surveillance on the college kid and done a stakeout and identified the car the kid was driving. And it wasn't totally clear to John. He didn't figure out exactly how extensive the surveillance was, but there was some, you know, things in there that made him think, like, are they going to his, you know, armed men stalking this student?
Yeah.
You know, did they go to his family's house? And I think, I mean, that's representative of, I think, the more, what I would say is like the more typical of the two buckets of militia activity that can be concerning. It's the sort of vigilante stuff, which is like, it's a low boil menace. I mean, it can, you know, it has a impact on, in this case, for instance, free speech. It's harder to speak your mind if you're worried that it's going to result in, you know, armed men showing up at your house. And it's really hard to predict, you know, what's actually a real threat and what is just kind of, like you said, weekend warrioring. But as these organizations grow and get more emboldened, I mean, it's always like this threat of violence bubbling under the surface with stuff like this. And to give some other examples of this sort of vigilante stuff, it's rounding up migrants at the Texas border in armed patrols. It's doing armed stakeouts of ballot boxes to try to intimidate voters dropping off absentee ballots. It's going to Black Lives Matter protests with guns and in some cases beating up protesters. And these are all things that have been happening in recent years and haven't really made headlines. And then there's, of course, the other side, which I think is the most fundamental one, which is the contemplations of violence. And in AP3, it was this escalating debate over whether they should assassinate politicians, whether they should assassinate their enemies on the left. And as far as I know, in the period I was looking at, they never actually went out and tried to do this. But it got to the point where, you know, long time senior members of this militia were quitting because they were scared. They were scared by all the talk about, you know, all the number of people advocating for committing acts of terrorism. These are people who have spent an enormous amount of time in the militia movement. They're not people rattled by a little bit of tough talk. I mean, this is the challenge for FBI agent work with this stuff. It's hard to tell what's bluster and what's not. And when it's not bluster, the consequences are massive.
Right. What is the significance, do you think, of President Trump pardoning the January 6th insurrectionists? I mean, you're right that the experts you've been talking to are concerned that the pardons could, as you put it in your piece, trigger a renaissance for militant extremists. So what are they saying to you about the implications for that?
you know, we're entering uncharted territory after the pardons. There is no precedent for that message, that sort of message of protection and support coming from the White House. And I think it's very fair to say that, you know, there are going to be extremists that interpret this as a license for more extreme action, as a kind of signal that one can commit violence and potentially go unpunished. And this messaging has a very concrete impact on militia activity. We were talking earlier about how these militias came off their deathbed, in no small part because President Trump began to make them socially acceptable again, began to praise them. That put the wind back in their sails, really. And to make them the center of the presidential campaign and then pardon not just nonviolent people who were involved in January 6th, but also people who assaulted police officers that day, people who were, you know, prominent militia leaders convicted of seditious conspiracy. It's an enormously consequential step. This is, you know, stop me if I'm taking us too far off track, but the moment in history that both militia leaders and academics were thinking about after January 6th was the Oklahoma City bombing. Early 90s were the last time that there was a real upsurge in militia activity like we saw in, say, 2020. And that culminated with the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which remains one of the deadliest terrorist attacks on American soil. And that led the movement to essentially go extinct for over a decade. And militia leaders were talking amongst themselves that they might see the same thing happen after January 6th. But one thing that would have been absolutely unthinkable after the Oklahoma City bombing would be mainstream politicians embracing the bomber, Timothy McVeigh, let alone pardoning him. And so, you know, that could really shift the direction of this movement, this sort of presidential action.
Joshua Kaplan, what happens, what was the reaction when, not just when you published this piece, but when John Williams publishes his anonymous essay saying that he had infiltrated the group, that he had acted as this, you know, independent activist? And what's been the reaction so far to the piece that you published as well? What are you hearing? Are you on a red list, I guess?
John, late last year, published this anonymous essay, as you said, revealing that he'd infiltrated these groups and had given me files that were among the files I used for this story I published last summer about AP3. And the reason he did that is he wanted to test how the militia would respond to news that there was a mole. And he really got what he'd been hoping for. It was this kind of wave of paranoia inside AP3, where the founder of the group, was telling people privately, you know, this is a lesson that, you know, don't trust anyone. By being in a militia, we put ourselves in risky situations and there are turncoats everywhere. And that is the reason that John wanted to go on the record with his story, is to, you know, become a boogeyman of sorts, to try to make it so these militias feel less comfortable bringing in new people, feel less comfortable being candid with each other. As he put it, he wants every time militia members are in a meeting, he wants them to be thinking in the back of their head, this guy will betray me.
Well, it seems like from the reaction, because you mentioned in your piece, one of the reactions was from one of the leaders, I won't use the language they use, but don't trust anyone.
You know, I think Don may be correct. He's identified a real weakness in these organizations that, someone like him, whose goal is really just to damage them, might be able to exploit.
Do you still hear from him, John Williams?
Yeah, he's doing well. He is safe and sound. Thank God.
Joshua Kaplan. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joshua Kaplan, he's a reporter for ProPublica. His article is called The Militia and the Mole. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can find us on Instagram at Radio West, or you can just email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.